Is this going to work if we share a mic? My computer's broken. I mean, I could go down and get another laptop. That's another thing I could do. But then the problem is it's not all loaded up with the stuff.
We'll live.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, let's go. I go first. No, you go first.
I go first, then to Viola, then to Anthony.
Rules are rules.
That's right. We've got to go back. I'm Will Howell.
I'm Viola Judah.
And I'm Anthony Fowler, and this is Not Another Politics Podcast. So we just had a midterm election. Neither side got everything that they wanted. It was kind of a mixed bag of things. But what's clear is there are pretty strong emotions on both sides. There were Democrats saying that our entire democracy was going to be lost if the wrong side won the election. Just utter disdain for the other side. The thought that, my God, could those people really support the candidates that they support and really support the policies they support and so forth. So there's this, you know, what we call this affective polarization, so to speak, that Democrats and Republicans seem to increasingly dislike each other, even hate each other.
So it definitely feels this way. There's some research to support that. If you look at the surveys of the American public, there seem to be more and more of negative feeling towards the opposite party. But there's one thing that I think is good to ask, which is this something that's happening all over the world, or is this something unique to the US? When we talk about the US, we very frequently hear people saying, all this affective polarization is driven by income inequality or is driven by the media. Facebook is all responsible for all these negative feelings that people have towards one another. If that's the case, then we should see similar patterns all over the world. So Will, you talked to someone who has interesting things to say on this topic.
I did. I talked to Matt Genskow, who teaches in the economics department at Stanford, who wrote a paper along with Levi Boxell and Jesse Shapiro called Cross-Country Trends in Affective Polarization. And in the immediate aftermath of the midterm election, where I think most people are diving into the details of the vote returns in Nevada and Georgia, we're going to do just the opposite. Because what they do in the paper is they accept your invitation, Viola, and they try to identify, right in the title, big trends in the extent to which people from different parties don't just distrust, but actively dislike members of the other party. They track that over about a 40-year period in a bunch of different countries, and then look at the extent to which a set of factors might correlate with those trends, having to do with the economy, social media, race, and elite-level polarization. Matt, it's really great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us to talk to us about your paper. You're drawing from a whole bunch of survey data. And in the context of these surveys, how do you go about measuring, or how do these surveys go about measuring this concept of affective polarization?
So, you know, the point of this paper, as we'll get to, is to look at these trends across different countries. So we assembled lots of different surveys from 12 different countries. The classic measure of affective polarization in the US comes from a question on the US National Election Study survey, which has for a very long time asked people on a scale of 0 to 100, how warmly or coldly do you feel toward people from different political parties? They present it as like a thermometer from 0 to 100, and so you might feel warmly toward people and so give it 100, or you might feel really coldly toward them and give it a 0. That's the question for the US. One of the challenges in this paper, since we're trying to go out and look at a bunch of different countries, is those questions are asked in different ways in different countries. So we tried to collect as many surveys, as many countries as we could, where some version of that question is asked. So people are asked some version of how much do you like, or how positively do you feel, or how warmly do you feel toward these different parties. So we're combining lots of different questions that are all worded in slightly different ways. And so the measure for the US, what we're calling affective polarization following the literature, is the average across people of the difference between how warmly you said you feel about your own party and the other party. So if you're a Democrat, it's your warmth toward Democrats minus your warmth toward Republicans. So it's some notion of the gap between the way you feel about your own party and the way you feel about the other party.
There's another kind of challenge, which is that in the U.S. we've got two parties, but in other countries we've got multiple parties. And yet you have a single measure that we're going to call kind of a measure of affective polarization felt by each individual. Can you walk us through how that's actually constructed? How do we think about that in a multi-party system? And how does that how does your measure allow us to make comparisons from what you back out from that to a two-party system?
Suppose you're somebody in one of those countries and we randomly pick someone else from the population who is not in your party. How would you feel toward that person? So if you live in a country where there's two main parties, A and B, and then there's like a little party, C, it's mostly going to be how do you feel about people in party B with a little bit of weight on how you feel about party C. We're going to average your reported sentiment toward those parties weighted by their shares in the population, basically.
Okay. So what do these trends look like? You look at 12 countries over the better part of a 40-year period, and what do you find?
We look at these trends for 12 countries over, I should say, about a 40-year period. So going back to the 1970s, we replicate the finding for the U.S. that, you know, others have found that affective polarization has been on a steady increase over basically that whole period. We see there are a couple of other countries where affective polarization has also been rising, but by less. So that's true for Switzerland, it's true for France, it's true for Denmark, it's true for Canada, where there's not anything close to as big a rise as there is in the US, but there's some increase over time. There are some other countries where it basically looks flat. There's no trend over time. New Zealand, Japan, Australia, Britain, Norway, all have like little or no change over time. And then there are a couple of countries, Germany being the one that stands out, and also Sweden to some degree, where you actually see quite clear decreases in affective polarization over time.
Yeah, so the big picture here then is one of the U.S. being an outlier in this regard.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, you know, we're trying to be a little bit cautious in the statements we make. So, you know, strictly speaking, Sweden has a trend over time, which is not that different from the US, but Sweden is a country for which we have very few data points. And certainly the data are consistent with the view that the US is an outlier and has a much bigger trend than any other country.
And so the next move that you make in the paper is to try to think about how a set of larger societal factors that are playing out in each of these countries correlate with the observed trends in affective polarization that are observed. You go and collect data on measures of economic indicators, changes in the media, changes in the racial composition of these countries over time, the actual levels of polarization, reference our initial discussion, like how much actual disagreement there is, and correlate it with the observed trends within countries on the affective polarization. And what do you find on this score?
The summary, I think, would be a lot of things that people have talked about as drivers of polarization do not look like they're correlated with or strongly correlated with these trends, meaning you couldn't guess based on those things which countries have polarization going up and which have it going down. On the economic side, something that people have talked about a lot as a driver of polarization is rising inequality. And so that's one of the things we look at. First thing you might note about that is inequality is measured by, like, a standard measure is what's called the Gini coefficient, which measures how much inequality there is in incomes. Inequality has been going up in almost all of the countries in our sample. And so this does not look like trends in polarization are very related to trends in inequality. The correlation is, if anything, negative. So that's one example. Another economic thing people have talked about a lot is globalization. You know, trade with China in the U.S. causing economic hardship for some groups or occupations, and that contributing to inequality. We also don't see any clear correlation either way between how much globalization there's been as measured by the share of trade in GDP and the trends in polarization. Another category of things, as I was saying, you know, looking at media, and so thinking about social media or digital media, one thing to say off the bat, like, these trends we're looking at are over a almost 40-year period. We don't see any correlation between things like the growth of internet penetration or the growth of use of online news and increases in polarization. And also more broadly, just the fact that polarization is not going up everywhere seems inconsistent with a view that those are key central drivers. Another media-related thing you can look at is television. So if we're talking about the 1980s, 1990s, that was clearly a bigger factor at that time. And so another media change that is really important if you're thinking about polarization is like the rise of 24-hour cable news and potentially partisan cable news sources. So we look at that too, you know, how much, like, measures of how much growth has there been in 24-hour cable news. And, you know, there's like a little bit of correlation there. I think it's notable that the United States is the country, or one of a handful of countries that have had the biggest increase in that. So the kind of boom in cable news is something which is pretty distinctive to the US. And something that we don't measure is how, we don't have a measure of like how partisan is the cable news. But I think if you could measure that, you would see the US is particularly distinctive in having this very partisan cable news. So I would say there's a little bit of positive correlation there and some evidence that's consistent with that being one of the things that could explain polarization.
And then you've got a couple of other measures that seem to be stronger contenders for something of an explanation for why we see this rise in affective polarization.
Yeah. The things that seem more related are basically three things. The first is the share of the population that is not white, or measures of what's called ethnic fractionalization, which is a little bit similar, like how divided is society across different ethnic groups, just in terms of population shares. The non-white share of the population, which is something that we might remember in the US has been growing a lot over this period, due to, for example, the Hispanic share of the population growing by a lot. How much that's been increasing is pretty strongly correlated with these polarization trends. The US has one of the biggest increases in non-white share and also the biggest increase in polarization. Some of the other countries like Canada that also have positive rises also have big increases in non-white share. A second is something that I think the political science literature has put a lot of emphasis on, which is party sorting, basically. So people who are conservatives there used to be some conservatives in the Democratic Party, partly because of the legacy of the Democratic Party in the South, and also conservatives in the Republican Party. There were some liberals in the Republican Party and also in the Democratic Party. Everybody was kind of scrambled up for various reasons in the 60s or 50s or going back in time. And that's kind of unscrambled so that the parties are more and more sorted by ideology, also more and more sorted by things like race and urban, rural status and education. So we do see some, you know, kind of weak evidence consistent with that. That's another thing that is biggest in the US. Finally, the last thing we look at is trends in how polarized the politicians are. And that has by far the strongest relationship here. There's a really tight correlation. So all of these places, all of the places that have big increases in affective polarization tend to also have big increases in elite polarization and vice versa. The US stands out, you know, just as it has the most increase in affective polarization. It also has by far the most increase in polarization of Congress. You'd want to note that the causality can be running in both directions there. It's not obvious that you want to think about that as an explanation for increasing affective polarization. It could be Congress is becoming more polarized because the public is becoming more polarized, or vice versa. But certainly we see those things really moving together. I think if you want to understand, for example, why Germany has this big decrease, why is Germany the country with the biggest decline in affective polarization? Germany is also the country with the biggest decrease in polarization as measured by like how their politicians vote in the legislature. And it's like a well-documented fact that the main big parties in Germany have kind of converged closer to each other in ideological space.
It's worth pointing out that on this measure of elite polarization, there are two moves that are being made here. One is that the shift from the mass public to elites, but it also is a straight measure of polarization. This is not correlating elite affective polarization to mass affective polarization. It's saying, how do the actual policy positions and policy disagreements among elites correlate with trends therein, correlate with trends with regard to mass affective polarization?
Yeah, absolutely. So this the way this elite polarization is typically measured is based on like roll call votes in the legislature. How do politicians from each party vote on actually specific issues and bills?
I mean, the strongest findings, by my reading, looking at the non-white share trends in country-level populations and how they correlate with their associated trends in affective polarization. That's a big one. And then the one about elite-level polarization. The former maps kind of nicely on a larger literature that emphasizes the importance of race in characterizing politics broadly and political division. The latter, though, is interesting, because the latter, I think, is where you put a literature on polarization with another literature on affective polarization into immediate conversation. And the literature on affective polarization really emphasizes the importance of group identities as the source of one's like or dislike. What this suggests, it seems to me, is that my like or dislike of you is informed by the extent to which we actually do disagree with one another. What we might think of as the cognitive dimensions of politics inform or are correlated with or are wrapped up in the emotional stakes of politics. And that, to my mind, pushes back against the very literature on affective polarization that is the launching pad for this research agenda.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and I think that's definitely one of the ways one could read this. Elite polarization reflects the gap on actual policies getting bigger. The stakes in who we elect have gotten bigger. I think definitely that is something that people in this country perceive. That, you know, I can remember times when I was first, you know, old enough to vote, that there was a lot of talk about, you know, the parties are all really the same and it doesn't really matter. You shouldn't even bother voting because, you know, what difference is it going to make whether this guy or that guy gets elected? Not a lot of people seem to feel that way right now about politics in the U.S. So I think that is absolutely one reading here. And I agree with you. It pushes back a little bit on saying this group identity and feelings stuff is somehow divorced from real policy views and kind of substantive instrumental stakes of these elections. Let me give you two other reads of that, which are different. So a second story is we've had that party sorting, and that's really the driver of both of these things. Elites are becoming more polarized because they're more sorted. Voters are becoming more mad at each other because they're more sorted. And that's why those two things are going on. And actually, that, you know, it could be in that story, the effective polarization has nothing to do with issues or instrumental stakes at all. And then the third would be voters respond a lot to what politicians are saying and to politicians' rhetoric. If somebody, you know, walks into Stanford proclaiming that they're a Republican and a bunch of people feel mad at them, part of them that feeling mad is going to be thinking about not just that person, but, you know, what Republican politicians saying? What is Donald Trump saying? There has been a huge increase, I think, in rhetoric among politicians, you know, dialing up of extreme negative rhetoric about the other side, saying negative things about the other side. Of course, there's always been lots of that, but I think the intensity of it has gone up.
So we previously covered the UK, Great Britain. And Great Britain is in the data here. And it's kind of interesting that we had read a study that was largely about, you know, the period from roughly, I don't know, 1980 to 2000, showing that polarization of a different kind, but polarization was kind of declining in Great Britain over that period. And you see that same pattern here in this paper. But then you also see that roughly right around the time that that data from that study ended, polarization is actually on the rise again in Britain. So it's a little bit nonlinear. So on average, it's kind of relatively flat, but it's really kind of going down between, you know, 1990 and 2000, and then it's kind of been going up again for the last 15 years or so. So it's kind of, I thought that was an interesting addendum to
our previous conversation. Episode. Yeah. And it's interesting too, if you look at the data in the United States, it is effectively linear. This is not a story of affective polarization taking hold in 2016 all at once. It's that there's a steady increase throughout the time period under investigation. And so if you want to explain why people are getting angry and angrier with the opposite side, you've got to have something that, an explanation that precedes the emergence of Trump.
And if you look at some other countries such as Germany and Australia, you also see some sort of, you know, oscillation in affective polarization. Overall, when I look at those graphs showing the trends in affective polarization in those 12 countries, it seems like it's really all over the place. There doesn't seem to be a clear story that you can tell there, even if you group the countries into two subgroups, those for whom polarization is going up and those for whom polarization is going down, and maybe think there are some different factors affecting these countries. It still doesn't seem like a clear picture, because in Germany and Britain and Australia, there seem to be some oscillations over time. So that is really something that I think is lost when we think about the US, because when we think about the US, this very linear trend begs an explanation. It seems like we really, you know, feel like there's some factor that's driving it. Like, otherwise it wouldn't be so perfectly linear. It wouldn't be so strong. And I think Matt's paper says, well, it's not so clear that there's one big explanation that we can come up with.
Yeah. I mean, if I was going to come up with an explanation, just looking at this picture and not thinking about the other evidence in this paper, which of course we will talk about, the obvious thing I would first think about is the gradual but steady and meaningful increase in elite polarization in the U.S. We have a few bits of evidence from other studies that I think are worth noting here. I mean, we know that, say, polarization in Congress has been kind of steadily rising over this period that we're studying. There's this nice research note from Druckmann and Lewandowski where they ask these affective polarization questions. And then they follow up with more specific questions. They, you know, so sometimes these questions are kind of vague. They just say, like, how warmly do you feel toward Democrats or Republicans? And they'll follow up and they'll specify, like specifically, we want to ask you about Democratic politicians or Democratic regular voters who vote for Democrats. And people's answers seem to be much closer to the answer. People's answers to the generic question are much closer to the answers they give to the elite question, suggesting that they're probably thinking about elites when they answer these questions. They're not thinking about, like, their friend Steve who votes for the other party. They're thinking about Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump. We also have this really nice paper from Orr and Huber, which shows that to the extent that there is affective polarization in the U.S., most of it seems to be attributable to policy preferences. So you do these experiments where you kind of do these survey vignettes and you randomize features of hypothetical individuals. If I also give people lots of policy information, the relative effect of their party starts to go away. And it's really their policy positions that people are kind of reacting most strongly to. And so if I put both of those two pieces of evidence together, it suggests that what will really increase affective polarization is strong policy disagreement with elites.
So I think I would be inclined to believe that those two are correlated. And I think I would be even inclined that they are. There's a causality that it's the elites that are moving in some direction, and then the affective polarization follows, because there's an easy story to tell. What I'm a little bit less clear on is what's driving elite polarization.
Sure. That's a recurring puzzle for us.
It is. It is. And how is it sustained in the face of persistent moderation among the broad public? Mm-hmm. It's striking, a number of things that appear either uncorrelated or negatively correlated.
I think the finding on inequality is a big one. Of course, you know, we have 12 countries and it's just a correlation, but it really goes against a lot of conversations that we had in, you know, political science about what might be driving polarization in general. And it's sort of theoretically very plausible. Once you have a higher income inequality, you do have people with very different interests about taxation and redistribution. So in a sense, theoretically, it would be puzzling if you didn't see an increase in real polarization when you see increase in income inequality. And here, when they look at effective polarization, they don't find anything. And as you said, if anything, they find a negative correlation. So for me, this was a very strange finding, and I don't even know how to think about it, but it's convincing that inequality is not the place to look at.
Yeah, that is interesting. You're right. I mean, you would think that more inequality means more disagreement between the political parties, but that assumes that there's this clear economic divide between the parties. And one kind of interesting thing is that in this recent era, especially post-Trump, the correlation between income and party is weaker than it's ever been in recent American history. And so even if there is this increasing income inequality, it doesn't so neatly divide the parties.
So the single best predictor in all the things that they look at of trends in affective polarization have to do with trends in elite level polarization. And again, the elite level disagreements about actual policy. This, to my mind, suggests that the very thing that we're studying when we talk about changes in anger is actually rooted in something other than identity, or it's sort of blind rage, or it's just I hate people who look different from me or ascribe to different groups just by virtue of them being in different groups. The anger that we observe in the United States is grounded in real disagreement and about policy, that there are real stakes involved in our politics. And yeah, I can't stand the opposition, but I can't stand them, not because they're just the outgroup. It's because they're assuming a set of positions with which I vehemently disagree. And that runs contrary to the whole literature on affective polarization, which is arguing that, yes, it's on the rise, the anger's on the rise, but it doesn't have much to do with anything meaningful when it comes to either position-taking or the ideological commitments of political elites. It's blind rage.
Are there obvious confounders here? Or is there, what about, you know, is there a reverse causation story? Is it plausible that one of the reasons there's so much elite polarization is because there's increasing affective polarization for some other reason? People start hating each other for cultural reasons, and then that means that
they
get
along,
the elites
we
don't
have
get
to
along
start taking
Congress
different positions.
And, yeah,
you believe that?
Yeah, no.
Right? I mean, everything that the literature that we have argues that no, it's for the most part, it's about the positions of elites shaping the views of mass publics.
Rising levels of anger among the public, for some reason that we don't know yet, changes who runs for office and who ends up getting involved in politics. And so, and it might not even be really widespread in the public at first. It starts off with just, you know, small pockets of angry people, but then those most angry people, they're the ones that go run for office and become party leaders and so forth. And they're the ones that, you know, determine who else gets to run for office. And this kind of leads to this gradual, you see, and they kind of go together.
Yes.
But you can't really disentangle. You can't say one was causing the other because it started with the anger, let's say. And
there's even a simpler story that sort of would go in that direction, that, you know, if people really become angry with the opposition party, then you as a representative of those people, so you're aligned with them, you don't really have an incentive not to work with the other party. You have an incentive to block any proposal that they are putting forward, because you know that your constituency will be happy because you stuck it to them. So I think one could tell a very simple story where, like, once I realize that my supporters who put me in Congress don't like the other party a lot, now it's not in my interest to cooperate with the other party. I want to say, yeah, I'm with you, and I also don't like them. I think they're crazy and they have horrible ideas. I don't believe that story. I do think that we have a lot of suggestive evidence that causality seems to be going in the other direction, but there might be some feedback effect of this sort.
Yeah, there might be. There might be. At a minimum, though, the evidence on offer here, it seems to me, puts the literature on affective polarization on its heels twice over. First, because it appears to be a feature of American politics, but it doesn't appear to be a feature in every other country. That calls out for explanation. And then the other piece is that, look, if you just look at this correlation, that the actual positions that are being taken by members of different parties at the elite level seems to correlate really strongly. So yes, can you, of course you can spin a story that somehow different kinds of elites are running, and then they feel on top of that a need to assume increasingly more extreme positions because for mysterious reasons, mass publics are getting more and more angry and angrier with each other across partisan lines. It's a much simpler story, though, to simply say that elites are polarizing on policy and the masses look up and say, my God, I really don't want the opposition party to assume power because there are real consequences in place. And that's what's informing the anger that I'm registering in these surveys.
Getting a lot out of the important research shared on this show, there's another University of Chicago Podcast Network show you should check out. It's called Entitled. International lawyers Claudia Flores and Tom Ginsburg have traveled the world getting into the weeds of global human rights debates. On Entitled, they use that expertise to explore the stories and thorny questions around why rights matter and what's the matter with rights. Subscribe to Entitled, part of the award-winning University of Chicago Podcast Network. So what are the explanations in the literature for elite polarization that do not go through the voters changing their positions or their affective polarization?
I mean, we had Andy Hall on the show, and he talked about his book. And I think I buy his story that, you know, like we said, it's not the voters. It probably does have something to do with just who we select to run for office. These people are who they are. They have their views. And often we it seems like we mostly just get extremists who want to run for office. So that, I mean, that explains that, you know, that's at least a partial explanation as to why there's so much polarization at any given moment. Why is it increased over time? You need some additional factor as to why, you know, why that was changing over time. It could be, I mean, part of what Andy talks about in his book is that the desirability of the office matters a lot. That, you know, if it's not a fun job, if it's not an impactful job, if it's not a high-paying job, then you're only going to get the crazy people to do it. And if, in fact, you know, if the salary is good, if you don't have to spend all your time raising money, if you can actually have a positive impact on policy, you might get some high-quality people to run. And I think we could probably tell a story as to why some of those factors are changing over time. And it's less desirable to be a member of Congress now than it used to be in the past. And so maybe you get increasingly only extremists who want to run. And probably there is this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where once it's mostly extremists in office, it's less appealing for a moderate to be there. And so it's kind of easy to get stuck in that trap, even though, I mean, in the same way that, like, with any model of multiple equilibria, we don't have a good story as to how you get into one versus the other. But once you get there, you kind of get stuck there.
So I really like Andy Hall's story, and it seemed to me like the leading explanation for what's happening in the US. But again, I think it's not such a good story when you start looking at the data from this paper. Like, I can see how running for office became less attractive over time, and that's why you attract more extremists. But why wouldn't it become more attractive in other countries? Well, that might be still fine. But then why would you see these cycles in Germany, in Britain, in Australia? It's hard, I think, to believe, and again, I don't know enough about those countries, but it's hard to believe that there were some changes that made suddenly running for office more attractive, less attractive, more attractive. So as much as I feel that Andy's story is probably part of the story in the US, there seemed to be something more happening if you are looking at other countries.
I have a paper that talks about geographic sorting being a contributing factor as well. Even if the voters' preferences aren't changing that much, it does look like there's increasingly this kind of geographic polarization where there are increasingly cities voting strongly Democratic. And, you know, we had Jonathan Roden on the show who talked about this exact kind of thing and the implications it has, say, for congressional elections. And then you've got suburban and rural areas increasingly becoming more solidly Republican and cities becoming more solidly Democratic. And one thing that even if the kind of average preferences in the public aren't changing that much over time, that kind of sorting could have important implications for the elites because it means that all the Democrats in Washington are coming from cities and all the Republicans are coming from suburban and rural areas. And especially the party leaders are going to be from these kind of extreme, you know, more mm-hmm. partisan places. And they're going to be unrepresentative of the rest of the population. And we know that, in order to become a party leader, you probably have to have a lot of seniority. And the only way to win, there's not going to be a Democrat from Kansas who wins five or six elections in a row. And there's not going to be a Republican from the Bay Area that wins any elections at all. And so you're not going to see a lot of these, even if there is a moderate that crops up every once in a while, they'll never become a party leader. And so the interaction of those two things together could also explain a lot of polarization, that the party leaders are increasingly extreme and the constituency of a typical member of Congress is increasingly partisan. And so that at least is exacerbating polarization that maybe doesn't explain all of it or how we got there to begin with, but it could explain why it gets exacerbated over time.
They do look at some demographics, and we should highlight them because here it's kind of mixed findings, but they're interesting. That if you look over time at trends in the foreign-born share, the relationship between that and trends in affective polarization is basically flat. But if you look at trends in the non-white share, there's a positive relationship. So that, if you were to point to the number two factor that they put forward, that's probably it, the non-white share or the ethnic fractionalization trend, which points in the same kind of direction as a contributing factor. That's not exactly what you're talking about, but it has to do with underlying demographic changes. And here, in particular, not as they relate to urban versus rural, but the racial composition of different populations.
So how do you think about this finding? So on the one hand, it seems like an obviously theoretically correct point, but on the other hand, if we look at polarization in the US, for example, which is, a place we know, do we feel like the polarization that we have here is a polarization of whites versus non-whites, which would be like the straightforward story of why polarization would increase when we have more non-whites? Or like, is it plausible that polarization in the US is a response to an increase in the fraction of non-whites?
I mean, there certainly are differences. Certainly non-white people in the United States are much more likely to vote for Democrats than Republicans. But it's not so stark. I mean, of course, there's lots of white people who vote for Democrats and there's lots of non-white people who vote for Republicans. And I also don't think that itself is actually changing that much over time. If anything, it's actually going the other direction. It seems like in recent years, the kind of racial differences between the parties are increasing. And the bigger differences are more along the lines of, say, education. College degrees are becoming increasingly predictive of partisanship, and income and race are becoming less predictive of your party.
But their positions, the positions of Democrats and Republicans vis-a-vis immigration policy are stark. At the same time, we see huge increases in the percentage of foreign-born share in the United States and who are disproportionately non-white. These are people from Central America and South America. It starts from about 3 million to the better part of 12 million between 1990 and 2010. And you then see Trump running in 2018, you'll recall, arguing that, that the biggest thing that we ought to fear is this caravan of people who are non-white heading to our border and about to wreak all kinds of havoc on our streets. And in that way, the idea that, partisan differences might be a function of changing the racial composition of the country and that it is activated quite deliberately, this is a story quite deliberately of trying to stoke fear and with it anger as a contributing factor, doesn't strike me as fanciful at all. It cuts to the core of some of the politics that we're observing.
I mean, it could be. So the story you want to tell, it can't be. I mean, I doubt, for example, that Republicans are thinking of Salvadorian immigrants as Democrats. I don't think they're thinking, I don't think that's factoring in here. It must be that it's just there's increasing polarization between the parties on immigration policy because of the rise of immigration. And therefore, that makes people who already have strong views on that issue feel even more strongly. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, there's this other piece, which is as the flow of people from Central and South America increases over time, that anxiety is accentuated, and that those differences that we observe at the elite level translate into real anger. Because my God, there's something, this is an acute story. We're about to lose our country because we've got all these people from Central and South America coming into our country. And I'm furious with the Democrats because of the positions that they're taking. They're the party of open borders. That those things hang together in a way that is reasonably coherent.
Viola, what's your bottom line?
I really enjoyed reading this paper. I think we talked so much about polarization on this show, either directly or mainly indirectly. It's basically weaved into almost any paper that we discussed. And naturally, we are very US-centric. And I think looking at this evidence, even though it's only from 12 countries and it's by its nature not really letting us identify causal stories, is really eye-opening. And I think, as Will said, for example, we should take some theories that we have about polarization in the US and try to look at whether they actually explain what's happening in other countries. And if not, then we should really search for other stories, because the patterns are very surprising and it's an important topic.
I have two things I want to say. The first is I agree with everything Viola just said. I think this is a really great paper, and it's great that they did this. It was a great idea to do this, because we can sit around and spin our wheels and fight about what's causing affective polarization in any one country. But by collecting the data from 12 countries and by looking at the trends over time, we can assess these kinds of stories, and we can say, does that story seem to explain the variation we see, and does that mechanism seem plausible? Do I get two bottom lines?
Yes, you
my
do.
My second bottom line is that this paper further convinces me that we should essentially stop studying affective polarization. It's just not interesting, and it turns out that affective polarization isn't really the thing. Well, the thing is elite polarization. Elite polarization is the problem, and when you ask people how they feel about the parties, they're telling you how they feel about the parties, which is they're mad at the parties because the parties are too polarized. But it's not that people are misinterpreting affective polarization. It's not that affective polarization is, oh, Democrats and Republicans increasingly hate each other, and they're gonna fight each other on the streets, and they can't get along, and their children can't marry each other. Like, no, that's all BS. And this paper shows that it is, that what's going on here is that it's elites. This paper, in conjunction with other compelling studies. And so I think my read is we should stop studying affective polarization as a really interesting thing in and of itself. And we should especially stop overinterpreting it as some terrible thing that Democrats and Republicans can't get along, or people of different parties are going to be violent and so forth. I just think all of that's overblown. And I think the evidence here suggests that's true.
You want to not only interpret this as suggesting that the affective polarization literature is misguided, it's that we should shut it down. Right? We should stop talking about it as a thing. I think, to the extent that the literature conflates the anger with like blind rage or identity politics or social group theory, this pushes forcefully, and as you say, other studies as well, against that notion. I'll say, I think that, and I agree with, okay, so I'm going to say plus one on what both of you said. The thing that obviously should come from this is when we do this cross-national work, is to try to think about what a design might look like so that we can tease out what's causing what. We might also want to look at subpopulations and their trends to the extent that the data allow us. It isn't just disagreement on average or anger on average. It's these things can be experienced in very different ways for very different groups. And when you think about something like, say, violence, which might be born of anger, it certainly has to be the case that that isn't a mass phenomenon, but we might worry about it insofar as there are small groups of individuals who could cause lots of harm, sort of direct harm, and also set in motion larger political dynamics. So what is the story here? It's like this was really terrific in shifting and expanding our thinking, but that there's a lot more to drill down on and to try to recover some research designs.
Mm-hmm. thanks for listening to Not Another Politics Podcast.
Our show is a podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy and is produced by Matt Hodapp. Thanks for listening.